You could have just said that. You know, I have a pet peeve. I've got a little picadillo, and that little picadillo is I hate it when people use overly military or overly technical terms when they could just speak in plain language. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. You got me, you got Trent, you got our friend Matt Scholard. Matt is a former pararescueman. Are we allowed to say former pararescueman, Matt? Is that like a Marine thing where they're like, I'm not a former Marine?
Sure. Once a PJ, always be, I mean, yeah, I go with former pararescueman. I'm trying
I say
to
it all the time
anymore. Yeah.
I can't wait. I say it and I'm still active duty, which is a thing that's in and of itself. Matt, welcome to the podcast, man. Thanks Cheers, for sitting boys. Down. How are you?
I'm well. Good to see you guys.
Good. Good, man. Hey, so obviously we want to talk. We always start, you know, with an intro with who are you? How'd you get to where you are and stuff? But just start us off, man. How'd you get in the Air Force?
How'd I get in the Air Force? Well, sort of like any aimless teenager in their late teens trying to decide what they want to do with their life. Heavily influenced by pre-social media time. I saw the movie The Perfect Storm, and having grown up being an avid surfer and windsurfer and just really at home in turbulent seas, I saw this movie and this helicopter and this boat sinking, this guy flies out and they're all cool and they're cracking jokes in the back of this helicopter, and they get to the sinking boat and this dude jumps out, swims over, cools the underside of the pillow, calmly introduces himself to these people in their most dire state. And I was like, yeah, okay, I gotta go do that. Thought they were a Coast Guard rescue swimmer. Went the next day to the recruiter, walk in. I was like, hey, I want to be a Coast Guard rescue swimmer. I just saw this movie, The Perfect Storm. The guy's like, man, that's really cool. Coast Guard ASTs are badass, but that actually wasn't. That was
so 0-2 when you hit the recruiter. What a great line that was too. Hi, I'm a pararescueman. I'm here to save you today.
It was like, wasn't it cool, right? It was like so fantastic. Classic, iconic. He's like in the back just complaining about having to jump in the water, like putting his little, you know, his neoprene hood on. But I think it was just like the demeanor in which they captured him, like this massively chaotic environment. And he swims over, super casual. And I was like, if this dude can find this this tranquility in the midst of this insane, turbulent, violent, angry sea, there must be something to that. And it really resonated with me. The whole water element of it resonated deeply with me. I started windsurfing when I was 7 years old, and, you know, just basically spent my entire youth seeking those sensations. So that just seemed like this professional outlet with which to channel this skill and talent that I already had, which was comfort in the water. So ended up at the recruiter, the Air Force recruiter, and at the time it was they got like a 3-for-1 deal for enlisting PJs. So uh-huh. he's like, oh yeah, yeah. But ultimately the catalyst was the movie The Perfect Storm. Like that, if I distill it down to a single defining moment, it was that movie. I had never heard of it before. Guy handed me a brochure. It was steely-eyed Mike Maltz on the cover. You know what I'm talking about, Aaron. He's like kneeling, looking all dreamy. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's what I need to do. So that was the catalyst, that was the drive.
I'll tell you, that's that trifold. It was either that one or the one with Ron Thompson, because that was one they had after Mike Maltz. Those two dudes are more responsible for the recruiting efforts in like late 80s, you know, Maltz was like late 90s, really to the early 2010s, because that was the exact same two trifolds that they had. Like, I was right in that.
Better looking dudes, you know, like I think that's what it came down to. Like all of us that went through, like we're like an average 6, a 7, not a good night. If the lights are dim, maybe an 8, but these guys were just pure 10s, man. Like,
yeah, all of us are deployed 7.5s, but they're like at home, bright light 10s. Yeah, 100%. Truly. So you had no real knowledge, no real information before you went in. You just kind of show up down to, at the time it was called, you know, Lackland Air Force Base. Now it's Joint Base San Antonio, but you show up to Joint Base San Antonio and you just start looking around. You're like, what did I get into? Did you have any experience with the military or any family in the military before you went in?
I did, actually. So I grew up overseas. My dad was a helicopter engineer for Sikorsky, and he took all these overseas government contracts, took a new one like every 12 to 15 months. So I grew up sort of on the periphery of military. I was never a military kid going to Dodd schools. I was always like a kid who went to local schools in Korea and Bahrain and Sicily and Australia, sort of on the periphery looking at these kids who were attached to the military. I think like any solid kid who was born in the early 80s and grew up in the 90s, Charlie Sheen really influenced me to want to be a Navy SEAL at a young age.
Of course.
So yeah. So when I was in eighth grade, I was pretty much like full send, like, okay, I think I want to be a SEAL. And at the time, my dad was working at Point Magoo, which is a Navy base in just south of Ventura, California, for like 9 or I guess it was like 12 months. And there were a few SEALs that rotated through So I was like, oh yeah, these guys are rad, you know, but apparently it's not all mustaches and UDT shorts. So I kind of like my desire to want to be a SEAL sort of waned slightly from that. And then we moved to, so I lived in Australia twice. I went there for early grade school and back for high school. And when I was there, my dad was sort of attached to this support team for the Special Air Service, the Aussie SAS boys. So again, it was just like these really influential, hard dudes that were confident, that were funny, that just carried themselves in a different way. And me being this, you know, angry punk rock listening skateboard shred and surfer, it was like couldn't really appreciate it at the time. But in reflection, it was like, okay, these guys were a huge influence on me. So when I got down to Indoc, yeah, it was, you know, it was a whole bunch of Perfect Storm wannabes. But I saw the same kind of vibe that I did growing up on the periphery of some of these global special operations units.
That's the best story I've ever heard. What is that like? You know, George Clooney, Marky Mark, Australian SAS, which is everybody's favorite compared to the other folks.
Sure.
And then, you mean the Navy SEALs? The best part about the story is you didn't join the Navy SEALs. So,
well, I would have had those dudes just been full time UDT shorts and rad mustaches.
If that's all it was,
that's all it was. I mean, at the time, you know, and Charlie Sheen quips.
Right.
Like, that guy was the king of quips, man.
That never haloed into a wedding. Convertible. Yeah.
Jumped out of a convertible,
right out off the bridge from his own wedding. He gets, what a big move, you know, like if you ever want to establish dominance on your spouse, answer a page at your own wedding and just bounce.
I'm just so gutted that in all the times that you know, we were deployed and on call and on missions, like on alert, we never had beepers. I think there were some guys up at, like,
you didn't get a beeper?
Well, I think in Bagram,
I had one on my first rotation.
Yeah, no, we never had beepers. We only had like radios, which were, yeah, it's so much more offensive because you can hear the panic in the voice over the radio, where a beeper's just like, do you have a payphone bank around here where I can respond to this?
Well, and it was the dumbest ever. Like, I'd rather have an LMR. Like, we talked about the beep. Like, it was, you know, my first rotation to Iraq was a torch rotation back when they called it those. But we had beepers, but it was the most pain in the ass thing because it was just, it was just a information transfer medium, but it was like just numbers. Like, if it was all nines, you just had to drop what you were doing and run to the top. But if it was all fours, then you could just like go call in. But if it was all ones, then it was just like, hey, you got to be back at a certain amount of time. That's so badass, though,
that you not only had a beeper, but it had codes. You needed to know the code. Like, that's what's up.
Well, and the joke was, is like, you'd never tell anybody the code. So you would be leaving for a meeting. You'd be like, hey, dude, if I'm not back in half an hour, send whatever code you want. Just send zeros to this pager, because then you could just look at your pager and be like, sorry guys, I gotta go.
That's so good.
I can't tell, you're not read in.
That's when you know your special operations. Is that the pinnacle, that is the beeper?
I think it is too.
So I think, again, once again, I sat on the periphery of being an operator. Never got a beeper. No matter how many rad missions you have, if you weren't summoned to said mission with a beeper, did you really even operate?
No. Did you really operate?
Yeah, we need to bring the pagers back.
But you made it to Indoc. Let's go back. And this is where the obligatory Indoc sucked stories have to come into play. So tell us about...
Contractually obligated for...
Yeah. You know, it's funny now, you know, that we're all in our 40s. Are you in your 40s, Aaron?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So now that we're in our 40s, I look back on the period of Indoc with so much just positivity. It's a period in your life where there was no other experience where every single day is like you live an eternity in it, right? Every day you have the opportunity to be challenged like you've never been challenged before. You have the opportunity to rise to the occasion or to plummet to your demise. You appreciate time in a completely different scope. Like, I've, in the years since then, and we'll get into some of the work I've done with a lot of special operations veterans through our nonprofit Beneath the Surface Foundation, but we talk a lot about the relationship to time. And if you guys recall, when you're going through selection or through Indoc or, you know, whatever it is that's called now, there was a period of time at the end of the duty day, which was, you know, like 5 p.m. or whatever, where you're on vacation for the next 12 hours or 10 hours until you get up to run to the chow hall. And it was just this, it brought so much presence and so much focus to every single day. Did it suck? Yeah, absolutely it sucked. And there were like ridiculous challenges and, you know, all the mental obstacles. But when I look back on Indoc, I look at it as one of the most profound periods of growth. And I leverage so many lessons from that time, literally every single day. This is a true story. I still do underwaters. I go to the pool all the time and do underwaters, but like I kind of repurpose it. I train for big wave surfing now, and it's a much different vibe when you're doing your 10 minute 30s and, you know, wearing pants than it was at Indoc. It's like, ooh, it's repurposing this. I still like to, you know, I hear the ones ready in my mind. You guys were always there, like little angels and devil on my shoulder. So the obligatory Indoc posts, like, yeah, I have all the stories. But I think what I would, especially as you guys being a platform for aspiring hopefuls, is it's like there is no period in your life quite as rewarding and challenging as Indoc. And if you just take each day as it comes, each iteration, each evolution as it comes, and find the value in the, like, there's always humor in it, and it's I don't know, I love it. I love how my knees felt and my back felt when I was going through it. I'm like, now,
so you're all positive. One of the things that I always think about is, like, we get on here with all of our, you know, peer group and all that other stuff, and at our age, everything is positive in retrospect. And if it's not, like, there's probably something seriously wrong with you. But it's like, it's so easy to pull out the positives, and I'm always worried that, like, some kid's gonna show up at the selection course and be like, those all guys they did was talk about how awesome it is. And we're, you know, then they get there and they're getting their face stomped in. We're like, well, no, we said it sucks too. But like, we just like gloss over it. We're like, yeah, it sucked. But also, like, I'm 40 something, and that period of my life was amazing. And it's, yeah. I think it's just hard for them to like suss out what we actually mean. Like, it's awesome because of the pain and suffering that brings the presence to the now, right?
Absolutely.
And the growth.
But look at how many... We'll kind of throw some shade toward the team guys, but look how many of those bros are making these fat lucrative paydays, putting dudes our age who didn't attempt these selection courses in their youth. It's like, oh, you're some big time Silicon Valley muckety muck. Like, come on out. I'm going to put you through a three day hell week and, you know, only charge you $40,000. These dudes are frothing for that experience. Mm-hmm. And it's like, come on, boys. But yes, it absolutely sucked, and we're all better men because of it.
Yeah. And that's why people want to pay $40,000, because people that have never had a chance to test themselves in that sort of crucible, they're like, I want to try that thing. You said something that immediately took me back, and it's just before. So the ins and outs are still a thing. You'll be happy to know at assessment selection.
I am happy to know that.
Yeah, they still are a thing. So right before that 12-hour vacation, right before you have made it another day without failing, without quitting, without injuring yourself, there was a distinct time period that I just remembered, and it was doing your outs.
Mm.
You had a 10-minute period to organize anywhere from two dudes to 150 dudes to do push-ups, to count off loudly in sync to everybody do the push-ups, and then you had to leave the pad. I'll be honest with you, that was probably the most stressful part of my freaking day, because I was usually the one that was leading the outs for these sort of things.
Yeah.
And I could not, it was, I can't even tell you the anxiety. My heart rate's at like 160 right now, just thinking how I would get people together in the dorm the night before we would go to training and be like, guys, the most important part of the day, it's not at the pool. It's not counting off on, it's not doing the runs right. It's not grassing gorillas. I need your focus for 10 minutes. I need you to be present, to get your rucks on, to get everything lined up, to hurry to get through this 50, you know, count exercise, because then we got to go. Because the second that the cadre heard you inside that building screw that up, or the second that you were just lollygagging, that's, I've never been smoked more in my life than at 5:30 at 5 night.
5 p.m. on a Friday.
Because you couldn't get off the pad. You couldn't get off the pad.
That door, you'd hear the creak of the door open, and you would just hear them be like... And then you hear it wouldn't close, so you knew that they were either holding the door open or there were like multiple instructors walking out.
I just had the most distinct memory one time of, you know, it was just guys were a little bit too, I think it was like a Thursday too. So it was a shitty day. Like, we're almost to Friday. Like, it was really close. And I just distinctly remember being out on the pad and watching somebody stomp out of the building as we were doing push-ups. And I could see the building, but nobody else did, because they were all facing me, because I was facing, the one leading push. And I just felt it. I just knew it was coming. And for, you know, 10 seconds, I knew the hell that was about to be rained on the team, and they didn't. And let me tell you, that was a special moment for me.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. So, you know, we won't belabor the NDoc thing. You get to your first unit and how did your view change? Because you went in, you know, with maybe some misconceptions, or you had a great breadth of experience before you went in, living abroad and seeing different teams and at least having some interactions with folks. But then you show up as a young pup to your first, you know, I think it was DM, was it not?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, 48.
Yeah, so sure. Showed up to DM as a young pup and, you know, hot and heavy in GWAT at that point. You were a couple classes ahead of me, well, maybe one class or two classes ahead of me out of the pipeline. So, you know, I distinctly remember what that time felt like for me. What did it feel like for you showing up to the first unit?
Same kind of concept, right? Like thirsty for knowledge, wanting to impress the older guys, but there was like less gravity on the ability to learn. Like when you're in the pipeline and you know you're going to all these pipeline schools and learning, it's like you're being fed with a fire hose. I know we always use that phrase, but I kind of repurpose it in that you have much more consequence in your learning, where you know you could fail I had guys in my apprentice course fail. Like it's like up until the you put your hat on and blouse your boots and walk off, like there is no guarantees that you're going to be a PJ. And at the time, I'll speak personally for me, I think a lot of my peers and classmates thought the same, where the end goal is becoming a pararescueman. You can't see beyond that point. You can't be like, man, I can't wait to get to my unit and crush my deployments and assess and go to the you don't see that. All you see is, well, I just want to make it through dive school. I want to make it through paramedic. I want to make it through the apprentice school. I want to make it through air ops. I want to make, you know, so everything, you have all these short-term goals and you have a series of learning and, you know, basically a checklist of what you need to accomplish before you get to that point. So once that gravity faded and I got to my first unit, it's like, okay, well, yeah, you have your 5-level upgrade. You have your green team to get your deployment status. And it's like, you still don't actually recognize what the end goal is. You sort of have to like reframe it in your mindset of like, well, is my goal to get my hat? Is my goal to get my 5-level? Is my goal to be deployable? Is my goal to save lives? Is it to, you know, rack up like chief over here? Like what is it that you're actually trying to do? For me, when I got to DM, it was an interesting time. I think it was an interesting time for pararescue as a whole, because the whole mission set of PJs was about to change from traditional CSAR to start doing CASVAC. So there was like a little bit of a heavy focus on prepping for point of injury care, medicine, trauma was being sort of ramped up. But it felt like being like a half cone again. Like you're a new guy, you're just, you know, you're trying to impress the old guys. But in looking back, something that is really interesting is it was almost like a turning point for the career field, where you had the old guard, all the older chiefs and seniors who didn't really have any GWAT experience. And maybe they had like a single deployment to Kandahar in 02 or 03, where they sat strip alert and didn't do a single thing. One guy, you know, Jay Lane had a jump mission. And it was like there was a lot of how pararescue used to be. And there was this active shift in what pararescue was going to become. And I was a part of that, how it was going to become, and so were you, Aaron, where like when we, so I'll kind of step ahead a little bit. When we got to that deployment, to that, you know, your initial first deployment, yours was a torch, mine was a bastion rotation. And it's you're there and you're pulling upwards of like 10 missions a day in a 12-hour period. You know, they're all point of injury, and half of them require some form of extrication. And you're doing insane trauma to the point where you finish a 5-6 month deployment and you've racked up 500 missions. And you go back and you redeploy and you go home. And you know, the chief walks up to you, who's never had a deployment similar to that. He's done Southern Watch. He was at PSAB. He was in Kuwait. He was in Iceland. He was in all these Korea. And now this, I'm supposed to find relatability to this guy. Oh, it's like, oh, you got, I don't want to do an imitation, because then I'll probably give away who it is. But he, you know, they come up and they describe all that what you were doing is like the most incredible thing, because that's what they wanted when they were young PJs. They wanted that Vietnam mission, that like, hooyah, jolly greenfield, let's go out and pluck dudes out of the jungle, that they never got. They were part of this kind of lull period where there was like, you know, post Cold War dudes, post Desert Storm dudes, And then they kind of just, oh, we're really good. We're all tandem masters and barrel jumpers. And, you know, we all have thousands in skydives and our, you know, our, that's like kind of our focus. So when it, when I recognized that I was part of this new era of pararescue men, it, it was, it, it kind of added a little bit more gravity, sort of some of that indoc gravity of like, okay, well, this is the real deal, right? Like our purpose and our mission is to save lives. And we are very actively doing that in a, you know, in this high stakes environment. So yeah, that was a long-winded answer to that. Circuitous.
I think we can relate. I mean, I remember, I still remember like those older guys being like the conversations that they would have with each other and try to have with us were totally different. You know, like the things that set you apart as a team guy back, like how many jumps do you have?
Right.
You know, I remember the first time, like you come back from like your first or second rotation and some like old chief is like, well, how many jumps do you have? Like randomly, you're like, who gives a shit?
How does that relate like, to fucking anything?
Yeah, I don't care at all.
Bro, I just got home from Afghanistan like 3 days ago and you're talking about jumping out of a plane into like a DZ or LZ, you know, back home. Like, I don't care at all about any of those things. And so like, there was that rift that was kind of weird. But like, as I get older, I kind of feel bad for those guys. Like you were saying, like how do you like go into work and be like, I'm in charge. Like your medal count is like over your shoulder. So you look like a war hero because you're in every country in Europe and the rest of the world just to be there. But you never like scratch the itch. And then like these young guys are coming back and like, they're like, yeah, I ran like, you know, X, Y, and Z on this last deployment.
You got a senior airman with 8 air medals.
Yeah.
First deployment. Yeah.
Well, there was even a derogatory term and it was soft wide. It was, you know, being in 90s, whatever, you know, being a 90s PJ, being a 90s Green Beret, being a 90s, whatever. And, it, you know, it was a derogatory term for the young guys to call the old guys that because it just hit. It was that post Vietnam lull. It was that, you know, in between. And unless you were at one of the tier one units that did some of the stuff where they were hunting war criminals over in UCOM, or if you were, you know, unlucky enough to be involved in, you know, Somalia in 93. Other than that, those were the two big ones. So you would have guys that really had, you know, even when we were going through, Matt, when we were going through the pipeline, you know, there weren't even the instructors that we had, and it was no fault of their own. True. They had never, they weren't able to prepare us for going somewhere. Just like you said, I distinctly remember when I'd gotten to Vegas, I got there right at the end of one of our sister troop rotations and my friend Robbie came back and I was like, how was it? He was like, oh yeah, dude, it really sucked. I got 159 missions in 3 months in Bastion. And it blew my mind. I'm like, you got 159 missions. That's 8 air medals. If it's 20 per air medal or whatever it was back in the day. But I'm like, you got 150. He was like, yeah, man. He's like, I just went out for 3 months, you know, to split it in half. And I got like almost 160 missions. It was every single time that you drop somebody off, you were re-rolling to a new mission. And there was no way for our leadership to be able to engage in any real sense with that. And I feel that pain because now it's the flip side. Now it's a bunch of old dudes like us. That was our experience in GWAT. And we got used to a certain way. And it ain't that way right now. So we're having a hard time communicating not only to people that want that experience. We have to be like, hey there, Turbo. You're saying that you want this experience. You want to go kick doors in and do stuff like we did in GWAT. That might not be the best place for you, number one. And number two, the world might not provide you that opportunity. So it's hard for us to communicate on the other side of that as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I haven't considered that. It's like we got ours. I don't know that I would necessarily wish that experience on many people at all. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think one of the things that did is it highlighted the leadership capabilities of the people that were of a different generation, right? Like if your entire like leadership, you know, style is I have more jumps than you or more medals than you, and that what you have to listen to me, like that's not going to fly once like all these dudes start coming back from the GWAT rotations.
Truly.
And just like now, if your entire leadership style is like, this is my GWAT experience, listen to me, and it doesn't relate to the young guys, like you have to find another way to get the job done.
Truly. I felt there was a mass, and it's, you know, it was a soft segue into post-military work, but there was a massive disconnect between the overarching leadership and Air Force Special Operations, pararescue community, in being able to provide some form of like operator maintenance, operator longevity during that time. I recall commanders, we would get home from a pump and they'd be like, okay, hey, yeah, they need to stand up this new mission in Afghanistan. I volunteered. Again, if I do it with a voice, man, I'm going to out these cats.
Just do it.
Listen, if a tree falls in the forest, Matt, and nobody's there to hear it, doesn't matter. Nobody's listening to this podcast, baby.
No, it's fine.
Go ahead. We're just here.
I think I know exactly who you're talking about too, and that guy's retired. It's fine.
He's fine, man. He can't even hear anymore.
Listen, like, bro.
But you'd be repurposed and repurposed and reassigned for this new mission, and it was just all about the glory, not the individual glory. It was about the like career field glory, the commander's legacy. And they put more fucking dudes in just the worst. You look back and it's like, what, how incredibly irresponsible were you with your absolute most greatest resource, which is the people around you, the team, the human beings underneath you. And you just thrust them into this cycle of which there's no healthy way to escape it. It took its toll on me. It took its toll on my peers. And, ultimately it was like, all right, this is no longer for me. And it's unfortunate because I loved my time as a PJ. I loved the dudes. I loved the stories, the banter. I still like people I'm around now get maybe 26% of my jokes. Whereas, you know, when you're on the team, it's like, you're batting like 99. The homies are going to get your jokes. Which,
so nice.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. But yeah, there was definitely some lacking in. I think the biggest for me, the biggest resource that was lacking was fucking relatability. You know, when you look to your chiefs and your commanders, and you know, you just want them to be like, bro, like I know what you guys are doing is fucking gnarly. I know the how difficult this is for you and for your team and for your families and for, you know, your mentality and your mindset and your mental health. And it was just like, yeah, good luck, guys. Here's
nothing has made me, I'll tell you, I have PTSD from this specific statement, except it's like, it's not necessarily stress. It's just rage right away. When somebody tells me, hey, I know what we're doing. I know you guys are pushing hard, but I need you. We're going to need to surge. We're going to need to really like, we're going to have to buckle down and we're going to have to press for, I swear to fucking God, dude. When I hear somebody, a military leader sort of bridge into that, I'm like, number one, you have no idea what you're talking about right now. You did not surge in the way that I surged. You did not just get off something hard like I got off something hard. And then number two, the audacity to sit in front of me and tell me that you're going to need more out of me after I just did this. It makes me furiously angry. And yeah. I don't know when it turned for me, but the first, it was, I had a physical reaction. I can remember the room where I was sitting and I can remember the commander that said it. And it made me want to stand up and just no military bearing, no, you know, trappings, whatever. Just be like, fuck you. You don't get it. I'm out of here. And I couldn't because I was in a leadership position at that time. And I just remember distinctly at that point being like, wow, you do not fucking get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've proved myself for how many years, how many deployments. I'm telling you that like I'm exhausted, I'm tired, but you expect
everybody needs a break.
We're going to push one more time. Like we didn't learn our limits and learn how to push past limits and even get into this fucking point. And yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's easier to forgive like the first generation of leaders once it all kicked off because, you know, I'm always trying to like find the positive in everything. It's like my toxic trait. But like it was their first time doing all this stuff too, you know, like, and I remember being an instructor and like I had like students breaking their legs because I had them running too many miles in their boots cold, you know, like, and I just hadn't thought about the math until I had like this like really strong student who legit like his legs just like snapped. Like he came back from the doctor and they're like, no, this isn't shin splints. They're broken. And I was like, what? And then like I went back up to my office. I started like, you know, writing out like how many miles these students are putting on every day, you know, in, you know, their boots and cold and like running to lunch and back, which sounds stupid, but like it was just putting the additional stress on them, which I hadn't factored into any of my calculus. And I'm breaking these dudes and I didn't even realize it until it smacked me in the face. And so like I think for a lot of these folks it was just like they had no idea what they were doing. It was their first time doing a GWAT, like the same as everybody else. But at a certain point it did, you know, like at a certain point, people should have figured it out. You know what I mean? Like my thing was always like when, you know, you go and they're like, yeah, you're fire and forget. And that's a good thing. I was like, oh, thank you for letting me know that as soon as I leave this building, you're don't not going to think about me for 6 months, and then I'm going to come back, and you're going to pat me on the back and be like, okay, time to do it again.
Yeah, because those same dudes, those fire and forget dudes, you're going to be like, hey, go do good things. You'll be like, all right, you get back, and your chief looks at you, or whoever looks at you goes, how'd it go? What'd we always answer? Oh, it's good, man.
Yeah. Didn't start like, my car? They're like, no.
Like, oh. Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay, cool. Well, you got 2 weeks. We're going to give you some leave, and then you got 2 weeks of like in processing stuff, but then we're going to start your individual phase again, and we're going to start this thing all over again.
I had a chief after a particularly challenging deployment like that, one of those, you know, Kandahar rotations that was just like pure violence. And I come back and it's just like, oh, you guys are so lucky. Oh, you guys are just lucky. I was like, what in the actual fuck am I lucky for? Like, you kidding me? Like, right. You know how many like children? Oh, man, it was just
right.
It's a dark and challenging time. Thought it was going to be a positive conversation. Now I'm just over here like,
it was. I'm still here for it. Joke's on
weeping,
you, Max.
Weeping in my Rembrandt shadow lighting here.
We're 30 minutes in. Let's make the turn. How did all this turn into positivity and nonprofits and all this
that's
other stuff?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked that.
That's so, called a Trent Segmiller way. That's how he does that.
I like it. So I took all these lessons and decided it was time for me to pack up my little beret and jump boots and end my tenure as an Air Force terror rescue man. As you guys, both of you guys will remember, Mike Flores and Pedro 66 on June 9th, we were prior to that deployment, Mike and I were on a deployment together. And I think on that particular rotation, we were the only two dudes that had kids at the time. And, you know, we were like mid workout and had a little chat one day. And it was just like this unspoken, but kind of like, you know, foreplaying around the whole concept of like, well, you know, if something happens, like we'll definitely look out for, you know, for you guys. And at the time, it was just like war hero movie bullshit. It didn't feel right. It was just like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Tell my kids I love them. You know,
yeah.
Like, let's, you know, whatever. And then I'll never forget June 9th, 2010, when we got the news that Pedro 66 was shot down. I was about to take a group of young three levels out to go get their, teach them, you know, some diving out at the lake. And Steve Coletti walks up and tells me the news, and everything just like internally crumbled. And I was on active duty for probably another 3 years after that point. But I never forgot this conversation that I had with Mike. And at the time, Mike's widow, Marisa, was living on the windward side of Oahu. She was still active duty at the time at Hickam. So I packed it up and moved to Hawaii for part my own reasons to kind of reconnect with the ocean, what ultimately brought me to pararescue in the first place. I kind of wanted to return to those roots to soften some of the edges, the sharp edges that I had earned over my time as a PJ. So I moved to Hawaii, and I lived down the street from Marisa and Mikey and Eliana. And I was really troubled, man. I was drinking every night, and, you know, pairing that with Restoril and Ativan and all the things to kind of silence the brain and to get sleep and to kind of, I was hurting, right? I was deeply wounded. I was feeling so much emotion and pain for the world that I had stuffed down to be able to navigate all these deployment rotations and deal with all of the just unfathomable human suffering and trauma. And I was looking for ways to just silence all that. So for me, the outlet was a lot of alcohol and benzodiazepines. And it didn't feel right. I hated it. I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be the guy that needed to drink a half a liter of Jack Daniels to sleep at night. I didn't want to be the guy that couldn't go to a public setting without throwing back a couple Ativan, or at least convincing myself that I needed to do that, right? The narrative was like, oh, I needed this. And I was like, I didn't want to follow the VA model of post operational mental health. That was just more medication and more just modalities that did not resonate with me at all. So I was pulled back to the ocean, back to the water. My last team, I was in Okinawa, so I was kind of, I had a little bit of solace in the fact that when I was at Oki, like I could go surfing, I could go kiteboarding, but then I still had to go and, you know, go to work and deal with people who were there, which people shall always remain unnamed.
We don't talk about Voldemort.
We don't talk about this guy, but anyway, so I get to Hawaii. And I spend every day, I'm surfing, I'm in the ocean, I'm free diving, I'm kiteboarding, I'm windsurfing, I'm taking Mikey and Eliana and my kids out every afternoon after school, and I'm pushing them into waves, and I'm surfing. And like, over time, like I'm gradually starting to feel like a little bit better, right? Some time and distance from the career field helped. I started to like study, mostly through my introduction to freediving, I started to study a lot of like different breath practices, and which ultimately kind of led me to like mindful practices of like yoga and more mindful movement. And when I started to pair these two things, I'd get up, I'd go for, you know, freedive or spearfish, and I'd go surfing. I'd come home, I'd kind of do like a little self-care, do some movement, and then I'd go out kiteboarding when the wind came up. And it was just like, I was kind of just going through this process every day of like upregulating and downregulating. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't have all these like, you know, cool psychological terms for it. But all I knew is I was starting to feel better. I was like sleeping through the night, and I had this massive breakthrough. I guess it was July 28th I can't remember what year it was, but basically there's a race every July in Hawaii where you paddle from the island of Molokai to the island of Oahu. It's like 32 miles across. It's across the Kaibi Channel. It's this like super iconic, they call it the Channel of Bones. This legendary Hawaiian surfer, Eddie Aikau, he like vanished in there one year during this historic event. So this channel is just like super iconic. It's full of the mana, like Hawaiian energy. There's like 3,000 feet of depth below you. It just really has so much gravity and energy to it. And I decided I was going to paddle on a stand-up paddleboard, a 14-foot board from Molokai to Oahu. And typically it's like this downwinder where you paddle and the bumps kind of push you, and you're basically surfing. It's work, but you're like surfing across this channel. But the year that I did it, there was this tropical storm which shifted the wind. So it's basically like blowing me to Tahiti instead of to Oahu. So it was so fucking difficult. And I'm like halfway through this thing, and there's like an 8-hour time limit. If you're not out of the water in 8 hours, like we're gonna come pluck you up because the tide drains and you're gonna end up, you know, like lost at sea. And you have an escort boat that kind of loosely keeps an eye on you. But I'm in the middle of the channel and I'm just kind of paddling, and I get like this like really overwhelming like emotional state. I'm fucking exhausted, right? Because I can barely see this other island. The island behind me is like vanished over the horizon. So I'm just like stuck in the middle of this channel. And the only thing to do is just keep paddling. But like, I step off my board for a second. I lay in the water, and I make this like conscious decision where like, you just gotta let the shit go. Like you're carrying around all this fucking armor. You're carrying around all these experiences, and they're letting them define you in this negative way. Like it was like one of the most intense, like, I'm not like a religious person, but it was like one of the most spiritual events of my life, where I felt this like maternal connection with the ocean that was essentially like leave it here, like leave this shit here. And I did. I got back on my board. I wasn't like, oh, all right, but it just, there was something I felt this shift internally, and I finished the race. I was the last one out of the water at 8 hours and 1 minute. They let me get out, and half the pro field had quit the race because the conditions were so shit. And I was just like, you know what? Like, fuck it. I'm going to do it. It's going to be, I'm not going to quit. I'm going to finish. And I did. And after that, there was like, I felt lighter. I felt like there was some, like truly something cathartic in how I reacted to that situation in the middle of the ocean. And after that, I started to make some conscious decisions. I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to like go back to work. I think I'm ready to like find what's next for me. And literally like a few days after I put that energy out there, I get a phone call from this random Seattle number. And I'm like, hello. And they're like, hey, we've heard who you are. You're a former pararescueman, that you're a waterman. You do all these sports at a really high level, you know, kiteboarding and surfing and all this. And we represent this concierge medical company that provides special operations medics for these like ultra high net worth people. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, whatever. And they're like, we will have a client. We want to send you to this private island to support them. And they're like, we'll, you know, we'll fly you to this remote base in Northern California, and then you'll fly private to this island. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Click, hang up, you know, like, good one, boys.
Yeah, you got me.
They call back and they're like, hey, this is the real deal. So I was like, all right, okay, I'll go with the joke here, you know. And then, yeah, I ended up like a week later on this private island with these really influential global billionaires. And I'm like, how in the actual fuck am I here? Like, how am I here? But I was surrounded by these people who had accomplished incredible things. Like, revolutionary. Like these, you know, these people are like the top 10 in the world. And here I am, just this random dude who is providing medical care in the event of emergency and teaching their guests how to kiteboard and surf. And I sort of fell into this rhythm where that became kind of my job, where I was this water sports slash former PJ guy. And I was going to these super yachts, and I was going all around the world with these billionaires. And all the while I was like, it felt kind of like fake. I mean, it was fake, right? Like this, their lifestyle is not my lifestyle. Yeah, I got to experience the periphery of it once again. But what I was lacking in all of that was like purpose, like deep purpose. It was cool. I love going to super yachts and surfing Cloud Break and these spots that I would have never gotten to go to in my life. And basically building a career-ish around what I did as my hard skills as a PJ and pair them with this new repurposing. But it just didn't feel right. And I really had this desire that I wanted to give back. I knew that my bros in the career fields were still struggling. I knew that people were still dying. I knew that people were still needed some type of care. And I wanted to still be a part of that. And I would have these pretty insightful conversations with people, these three comma club cats that followed their own purpose. And created something beautiful. And I was like, okay, well, I have this idea where I really want to share and repackage my own personal journey in a way that is meaningful for others. And that's where the whole concept of Beneath the Surface Foundation began. And we gained a lot of traction early on and got a lot of funding and were able to provide some really meaningful impact for a lot of special operations veterans. And what it was is we basically repackage the upregulating and downregulating effects of post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. So you see like the upregulating, they call it like thrill seeking, right? Like we want because we are so heightened with our experiences in combat, there's a lot of neurochemical activity now. We get serotonin, we get dopamine, we get all the norepinephrine, adrenaline, all these things that like neurochemically are really intense, and sometimes they feel really fucking good, even if in the heat of the moment we're like, this is terrible. When you finish a mission and you've survived that and you've escaped, there's nothing that feels like that. And I know you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. But when we don't have that environment, we look for those sensations in other ways. We look through reckless behavior, through base jumping off buildings in Vegas, through drugs, alcohol, promiscuity, sex, reckless driving, buying a fucking Ducati, and you know, these ways that a lot of the people in the greater special operations career field were sort of falling into. Simultaneously, we look for downregulating in alcohol and drugs and in benzodiazepines and medication. And that's sort of where we kind of modeled this whole, okay, let's make sustainable practices of upregulating, which we introduced through water sports, which is my own personal passion, kiting, big wave surfing, windsurfing, all these sports where you have to learn, you have an end goal, you get immediate feedback, you have all of these opportunities to upregulate. And then we introduced downregulation through teaching very conscious breath work, yoga, mindful movement, meditation. And what we were trying to do was introduce these sustainable practices that could somewhat replicate what you were seeking through upregulating and downregulating destructive behaviors and making them available to these special operations veterans. So we did these through what we called immersions, these 10-day events where we took these dudes to, you know, remote islands and put them through this. And it gained a lot of traction. Like we had a clinical psychologist on board and had funding to run a proper study. And then COVID happened. And
oh man.
Yeah, COVID? The old spoke in the fucking front wheel.
Oh geez.
And it really kind of forced a lot of repurposing, which was quite hard for us to do when our deliverable was actually in person with people, hands-on, having meaningful conversations, having, you know, taken a 20-year DevGuru operator and strapping him to a 9-meter kite and him being like, I have not been able to turn my brain off in the last 6 years. And all I could think about for that 30-minute experience was being tethered to this piece of nylon here. And it was huge, man. It was very deeply impactful work, not only for the people who came through our immersions, but for me. It was like this continued trajectory of like, okay, this is why you went through all of those experiences. It was, I like to use the phrase, it's cheesy, but I love it. It's like my motto for the entire time I was a PJ was that others may live. And that's still my motto. It's still my guiding ethos. But now living has a different definition. It's no longer just vital signs. It's like, how can we actually breathe life back into these people who have, you know, given so much to others? And with that, I need a sip of water.
So, but then we're on the back end of this whole, you know, thing, and I'll hold my opinion of COVID and the pandemic and the way that we all kind of like responded to that. So it kind of had to feel like a shot, right? It kind of had to feel like another thing where you're like, man, I thought I was close here. I thought we were doing some good. I thought, you know, I'm really getting close to doing something that I feel like has meaning. So how did you transition into the next thing there?
Great question. So all the while that I was doing what I was doing through Beneath the Surface Foundation, it was deeply rewarding, but it still was missing something. There was an underlying element that I was deeply drawn to, but that I couldn't quite put my finger on. And over the succession of probably, I don't know, 24 people or so calling me after their immersion, and they're being like, dude, what's next? It's like, what's next? I have this new lease on life. Like, I wake up every day, I'm inspired, I'm motivated, I have closer relationships with my kids, with my spouse, I'm seeking purpose at my job. Like, what's next? Like, I need something next. And I think that's where I kind of went on my own little vision quest and was like, what I'm ultimately passionate about is this state of optimal psychology that is gaining a lot of traction lately. It's called flow state. And it was coined by this Hungarian psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And it basically, it's the state of optimal psychology where things are moving effortless and we're rewarded and we're intrinsically motivated by what we're doing. And we're so deeply immersed in the thing that we care about that nothing else seems to matter, is sort of like the underlying theme. And when I went back and I looked at my whole drawing to why I became a PJ in the first place, why I decided to do all the things that I did, what I found value on during my time as an operator and post that, it like all the little like lines in the giant red circle all went back to chasing this experience of flow. And so I full send dove into all the studying and research and certification. I became part of the Flow Research Collective and was working with all these world-class neuroscientists on capturing data and running studies. And I just became absolutely fascinated by it.
So you're telling me your type A personality that just walked in and decided to be a pararescue man after looking at a video, you're telling me you went full send just into a rabbit hole, 100% of your attention? That doesn't sound like you, Matt.
If you can believe it, I know there's a bit of, you know, your bullshit meter is probably getting pegged there, but there. So where I went from that was like a couple different iterations of experimentation on like how I wanted to package what it was that I felt I had to offer the world. So for your listeners, especially the ones who, you know, are still aspiring hopefuls and sort of don't know where they want to apply all of their focus, there's a whole formula. We call it like the passion recipe, where you have a list of curiosities, right? You have all these different curiosities in life. Where curiosities start to merge and you have these little intersections, that's what creates passion, right? So like you're really curious about X, Y, and Z, but through the intersections of all those, you identify that you have several of these passions. Now, we all have a lot of curiosities, just a few passions, but purpose is when we apply our passions externally, when we give them back to the community. And for me, it was all of these different passions that I found in my pre-military days, what I enjoyed as being a PJ, and what I've celebrated since being a PJ. And I've repurposed all these passions into something very purposeful where I give back to the community. And what it is, I just want to lead, inspire, and mentor people to be the absolute best version of themselves. And my personal guiding philosophy is that when you have an external high source of flow, for me, I'm an extreme sport evangelist, so I definitely lean heavy into encouraging people to pursue some type of action adventure sport. I truly believe that, like, that's the shortest path to enlightenment, and that's what gives people the most value in life. So I have my own personal brand, my company, which is Session X, where it's a synthesis of 30 something years of action, adventure, extreme sports, military special operations, and being around some of the most incredible peak performing individuals and what I've learned from them. And it's all packaged into this little neat little coaching platform that takes ordinary people who have extraordinary goals and gives them a military style step-by-step checklist on how to get there. And that's,
you wake them up at 4 a.m. and start screaming at them.
Speaking of, dude, sleep is our superpower, brother. You sleep until you get your 9 hours, my man.
That's it.
No, it's the, I lean very heavily into I work with a lot of Red Bull athletes. Like, I work with both people who are not athletes and people who are at the tip of the extreme athlete sphere, as it were. And I work with a lot of, Red Bull, big air kiteboarding, big mountain guys and girls. And the military application, it's the mindset that we all earned in our youth during our respective special operations courses. And there's actually a pretty direct correlation to intense physical training that has probably the most profound influence on our mindset. You can read all the self-help books you want, but if you make it through a pool session, if you make it through a week 8 in-doc pool session, that is going to carry far more impact into your hoo-ya, never quit mindset, to your risk calculation, to all these things. So when I say that's a military application, it's more about how do we get the mindset of a special operator, but with the wisdom of somebody who's on the other side of it. So for a lot of these, we'll call, the big air kiteboarders, it's the phrase is like having the balls to pull the trick, but the wisdom to know when not to. And that's sort of the one of many of the onion layers of the brand here.
It's such a cheesy thing for me. This is a cringy thing for me to admit, but you get kind of hyper-focused on stuff, and I think there are people out there that are doing like grade one is like kind of what Trent joked about, which is like, they think that instilling this sort of mindset is waking somebody up and making them uncomfortable and yelling at them and inducing stress in the ways that they think that they can. They do it ham-handedly, and they do it in a way that we all kind of cringe at, right? But for me, the first time that I realized it's, and this is going to sound again pretty cringy, but when the first time that I realized that civilians were lacking some of these basic things that we take for granted, backwards planning, the pragmatism of knowing what risk management is, knowing how to make an event flow correctly. And that, really all that is a lot of time management, but those things were like beaten into our heads. Mm-hmm. The first time that I really like realized the connection between intense physical exercise structured in such a way that it actually provides a good neurological output was listening to Joe Rogan the first time that he did Sober October. And about 15 days in, they were finally like tracking their data. It was, him and a bunch of comedians, if you're not familiar. But Joe would talk about the mental clarity that he would get. And he would be like, yeah, because I forced myself to wake up 2 hours early today. I did this intense physical workout. And then I had to go through my day and I had to do all this, mental discipline in order to stay on. And it was really hard to get through. But then I started to feel like he was describing being in a flow state, but it was before the words flow state existed in the terms that they do now.
But what you described there was that Joe forced himself to do that. It wasn't Trent yelling at him at 4 a.m. Right. It wasn't some external. It was intrinsic. He had the drive to be like, I am going to make myself uncomfortable to do that. And that's where that switch is internally. When it's like, well, you don't need me anymore. I can give you the tools, but like, you have all that you need now. If you're like, my shit's going off, I'm up and at him doing my 108 counts or whatever at the crack of dawn. So yeah.
Well, and I think that's the difference between you and, to be, quite honest with you, everybody else out there is like, your goal is self-coaching. Your goal is to set people off into the world so that they can get into their own flow state, whether that's through, hyper-regulation and dysregulation of their own systems in order to find a good homeostatic level where they can be like, okay, I know what it feels like when I'm keyed up and I know what I have to do in that moment. I either need to deregulate or I need to go ahead and press hard, because now is the time when I'm focused and I can get into that flow state. Like, that's, looking at all your stuff and following you from, the very beginning of, Waterman Fitness all the way through to where you are now. that's always been your goal. Your goal has always been to provide the tools for the people to move forward and not just have an experience that lasts 72 hours. And if you make it, you make it. Like, that's never been your goal.
Absolutely.
Well, I think for the folks out there that, you know, our typical audience, we've talked about this before. That is, there is a stage in the pipeline where, like, a team, maybe not every individual on that team, but as a team, like, you do come together and cadre show up and they're basically just like there for no reason, you know? And as a cadre member, that's the best time, right? Like, towards the end of a course or whatever, and they are a self-regulating entity. They know what they need to do. They're doing it because they want to do it at this point because, you know, you've beaten certain things into them, but like they can see like the carrot at the end, like the goal is about to be achieved. And I think that's what sets them up for that, right? Like they can set a goal and then they understand how to do it themselves and what it takes to get there. And that's the physical exertion, like get too tired to like lie to yourself, you know, find that self-integrity, find out where your roadblocks are, and then get after it from that point on.
Man, I love that you bring up the group flow concept at the end of the pipeline. That's the best example that what I see, especially in the work we did with a lot of retired and former operators, was that when they don't have that eye on the prize, they don't see that carrot on the horizon anymore, then they're like, well, where do I even apply? I have this drive. I accomplished incredible things. I spent, 11 years at special mission units and all this. Like, I have so much to offer the world, but I just don't know where to offer it. And they sort of get pulled into this pit of like, well, fuck, what do I do? You know, I'm a warrior with no more war. I'm damaged. I have nothing to do. And that's where, when you have this extrinsic motivation of, for me, my model is action and adventure sports. I believe so heavily in, these nature-based extreme sports that like that then becomes the carrot that you frame your life around. That becomes what you train for, what you go to bed early for, what you work out hard for, what you plan your life around. Yeah, you may work a shitty job that you're not a fan of, but you know, in 3 months you got this trip to Namotu and Fiji and you're going to go down, and that's going to motivate you to get up. That's going to motivate you to get your affairs in order and stay on top of things and give more texture and purpose to your life. And there's an infinite number of ways to package this mindset and this concept. That's just what I have found to be my most significant. And that's the unique story to me and my brand, which is where my carrot then becomes no longer it's getting your hat and getting to go to your unit. It's like, okay, well, cool. How can I, go off and do these life-changing dances with nature?
Well, man, looking through the website, and you can find Matt over at sessionxcoaching.com and everywhere. You can find him at SessionX on IG, and we'll link to everything down below and we'll put it out on all the promo because we're professionals. No big deal. I don't know if you know this, but we're actually the unofficial official podcast of the United States Air Force and Air Force Special Warfare.
Such a flex.
Well, we just made it up. We just keep saying it because, we have a podcast and they don't. So we can just do whatever we want.
Seriously. It's your own podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. No kidding. Or I mean, I don't know. Maybe you buy a smaller podcast that's already doing it for a fat government contract. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Just throwing shit out there.
Hey, just saying it. But man, looking through stuff, something I really resonated with is one of the taglines here, and it's a bulletproof body and an unbreakable mindset, guided by purpose, living to the extreme. Man, that's who I want to be as a human. Yeah. As a man, like that's not just as an extreme sports athlete or as a, I'm a BJJ guy myself and I'm contractually obligated to bring it up every podcast. Trump loves it.
Nice.
But those things, I really connect with, when I was rolling yesterday, like fourth or fifth round deep, I wasn't thinking about, oh, do I feel good mentally today or whatever. I was present. I was like, boy, if I do not move my arm right now, this guy's going to break it off and he's going to take it home with him. And I can't let him do that because I got to be better. And it does get me to bed earlier. And I do resonate with all of those things, a bulletproof body and an unbreakable mindset, guided by purpose, living to the extreme. And that's where you make your home. Like, I guess I just want to kind of pick your brain on when did you get that clarity to come up with that? Because you can tell when something is true. You can tell when somebody is, they believe what they say and they think that thing to be true. And I like reading it there and talking to you here and knowing you for as long as I did, I believe that to be true. So how did you arrive to kind of that ethos for Session X?
That's a good question. And I just want to touch on what you described with BJJ, right? So there are 22 known flow triggers, and these are conditions that are circumstances that kind of set the stage for you to drop into flow. The more that there are, the more opportunity you have. Things like clear goals, risk, immediate feedback, consequence, a desire to be there, challenge skills ratio. When you're in jiu-jitsu, every action has a reaction. You're focused. You want to be there. So there's a number of triggers, probably, you know, 10 that exist. BJJ is an incredible flow trigger. For extreme sports, you have a whole different set of circumstances. It's the same thing, right? Whether you're a jazz musician playing at a club, whether you're, you know, a white belt going to your fifth class at jiu-jitsu, whether you're a base jumper, whether you're a big air kiteboarder, a big wave surfer, like we all neurochemically experience the same thing. It's just where our curiosities have clumped, intersected to make passions, and now how we apply our purpose. So so we'll kind of reverse engineer it. Living to the extreme, that's scalable. That's subjective. That's whatever your definition of it is. Extreme is very scalable, especially when you talk about extreme sports. For some people, I work with a lot of and have the company of friends who are all, you know, global powerhouses, Red Bull athletes, you know, these guys who are out charging 90-foot waves, and all the way down to my local community here in Hood River. It's built around action adventure sports. It's the windsport capital of the world. We have the mountain, but it's all scalable. Extreme is scalable for all of these people, whether it's Kai Lenny tackling a massive wave at Nazare, or Tom, the nurse anesthetist who's going up and shredding some, you know, powder on a Tuesday morning. Neurochemically, it's the same experience. We're all seeking that same thing. Guided by purpose, though, is where if we don't have purpose in our life, we're kind of aimless. Like we as a human species are hardwired through evolution to want to cooperate, to want to support others so that we can propel our genes to the next generation. Like you can't fight biology and evolution. Our innate desire to survive and breed has rewarded us over millennia to like cooperate with others. If you and I work together on something, it's going to feel better neurochemically than if I got there on my own. If we all come together and we innovate and we do this project, it's going to feel better. It's going to be more fertile, more opportunistic. Purpose is when we apply our passions externally. We all need that. We all need some form of purpose. We all had that when we were operators or still are operators. We had at least an illusion of purpose. We have a propped up purpose that really targets our developing young adolescent brains of like, well, hey, you know, see the world and that others may live who you are. And you think you have purpose.
Right.
And purpose can change, right? Purpose can always evolve. I thought my purpose in life was to support the healing trajectory of special operations combat veterans through the Beneath the Surface Foundation. It was great. However, it wasn't the full scope, and my purpose may shift in 5 to 10 years, but here I am right now in this present moment. My purpose is to bring the best out of you. And then the bulletproof body and unbreakable mindset, like, man, this is the container with which we experience life in. I've lived in this one for 42 years. I've done a lot of really cool shit. And like, if I don't take care of this, and if I don't maintain what I have and seek to improve it, my ability to experience the things that I want to experience is going to diminish. And I don't want that. I really love the freedom that being physically fit. Yeah, I have a ton of lagging injuries. I have a lot of city miles on my chassis, but like I can still go out and do things with the best of them. And for me, that's like my guiding purpose. I wake up, I smash the kettlebells, I'm at the pool 4 days a week. Like, But it all surrounds me chasing purpose, chasing my definition of extreme living. And the mindset, like it's fascinated by it. How did the three of us make it through these selection courses that 90 something percent of other people did not? What is our unification? What is like at a neurologic sub, whatever level, like why did we make it through? And can it be scalable? Can we teach it to others? And I think it can. I think it can. I think if you have something that you care enough about, you can accomplish your own definition of impossible. So to answer your question, Aaron, there was no defining moment. It's just been a synthesis of the lessons that I have learned over my life and trying to be as present as I can, and my own hobbies and lifestyle have really granted me a lot of presence. And it's through those moments of reflection and post session clarity that I'm like, these are the things that matter the most to me. And that's where my mission statement evolved from.
So with all of those things behind you, with all of that experience, all those city miles, you know, living abroad, from, you know, wanting to be a SEAL and jump off a bridge at your own wedding with a beeper, which is obviously peak manhood, right? But, you know, through all of your traumas, your trials, your tribulations, through all of those experiences, I mean, we always ask people for advice, right? And we try to spring the question on them so that we get an authentic answer. But for those folks that are out there, they're listening to your story and to your journey, and they want to know more about, you know, getting into a flow state. You know, first of all, you know, go find Matt at sessionxcoaching.com. Like, I'm happy to make sure that that's linked out there. But usually what we do at the end is we say, hey, you know, what's your advice? So for those folks out there that are listening and they want to try to do something impossible, and they want to try to do something that gives them that sense of purpose, that starts those building blocks so that they can eventually get to where they're living more in a flow state than they're not, because that's the end goal, right? What kind of advice would you give to those folks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I was around the billionaire circle, when I was running in that group, I used to play this game with people where I would whoever the client was that I was supporting, I would ask my friends or people I would speak to, like, if so and so walked up to you, we'll use Elon Musk as an example. If Elon Musk came up to you and he said Aaron or Trent, I will give you X amount of funding. You will never have to worry about working or money ever again, but you need to live a life of purpose. What would you do? And it's funny because, I don't know what I'd do.
Grow up, Peter Pan.
And it's like, as an adult, and most of the company I keep are adults, it's like, that is one of our number one concerns, right? Like, well, what do I do for my profession? Most people's professions define them. Well, I'm a pararescue man. I'm a Navy SEAL. I'm a doctor. I'm a this or that. It's like we are often defined by our professions rather than defined by our purpose. And when you strip away that title, what's left of people? When you strip away I'm a PJ. When you strip away I'm a SEAL. Like, what's left? Who is the person underneath? And what is the legacy that you want to impart? What is your intrinsic, your internal compass telling you that you need to do? So that would be my game to the people who want to take anything away from this conversation, is like, if Elon Musk were to grant you the black credit card that will make all of your dreams come true, what are your dreams? What is your purpose? And what do you do with that gift? And how do you shore up your physical and your mental and your emotional health so that you can enjoy those things, that you can make the most of this experience that you have? And for those who are, you know, looking at a career in some form of Air Force Special Warfare, like, ask yourself, like, what is the purpose? What is your motivation for doing so? And if your motivation is, well, I want to go jump out of airplanes, that's probably not going to get you through some of those darker times. For me, what got me through was I wanted that perfect storm mission. I wanted to be the guy that went out when nobody else could. They're like, well, we got these gnarly seas. Well, we're going to send Matt, because Matt's the dude that can handle that. And whatever I was doing, gupping underwater, you know, on an 80 meter underwater, like, whatever it was, that was in the back of my mind. And I was like, I need to be ready for when I'm called to do that perfect storm mission. And that was all because of Elon Musk at the end of the day.
Elon Musk. Yeah. The biggest.
Gave me my beeper.
He finally gave you your beeper. Matt, I want to turn it over to you to tell everybody where we can find you and where it is that they can engage with you so that I'm not messing it up. So where can people find you, Matt?
Yeah. SessionXCoaching.com is the platform. Hit me up on IG @_SessionX. But I think it's to the point now, the algorithm is like, yeah, if you just write SessionX, you'll get there. I got a YouTube, starting my own podcast, the SessionX podcast, the intersection of extreme sports and peak performance. I have, using my Rolodex of extreme sport athletes and friends, sitting down with them and trying to capture the underlying essence of what extreme sports provide on their lives. Soon I want to do have a couple shows lined up with the intersection of extreme sports and special operations, which is pretty profound. As operators, we know enough to be dangerous at a lot of things. Man, do we know enough to be really deadly for ourselves.
To ourselves, right?
To ourselves, mainly. Yeah. But yeah, YouTube, IG, and I think there's a Spotify one on there if you want to hear more musings. But mostly it's about extreme sports related stuff. Which, if you're an aspiring cone, man, get out there and take some waves on the head. You'll have no issues with water confidence, for sure.
Hell yeah. Matt, can't say thanks enough. Thanks for coming on. Everybody go find Matt over at sessionxcoaching.com on his IG, on his YouTube. Make sure you're subscribing to get that algorithm, a little bit of that stuff that the algorithm likes, to get Matt out there and get the goodness of the intersection of extreme sports, mindfulness, flow state, the entire thing. So Matt, again, man, thanks for everything you do. Thanks for your service. Thanks for your continued service to this thing that we're trying to do. We appreciate it. Everybody else, train hard. See you next time.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you, boys. Yeah.